From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the publisher of the New York Times, Arthur Sulzberger Jr. He took over the position from his father 8 years ago. Sulzberger's family has been publishing the paper since 1896. Then we'll talk with Alan Siegel, who has been called the New York Times word czar. He's overseen usage and style at the paper since 1977. He recently co-wrote the Times new manual of style and usage. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the world premiere recording of Die Bürgschaft, The Pledge, Kurt Weill's 1932 opera that was revived last year. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Microsoft Corporation says it will quickly appeal a federal judge's order that it split in two. The giant software maker's general counsel said it could take as much as a year to appeal today's decision by Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson. Attorney General Janet Reno praised the decision, saying it would promote competition in the software industry.
The court's remedy strikes the right balance. The structural remedy will stimulate competition that will have a lasting impact on this important industry, and the interim conduct relief will ensure that Microsoft cannot break the law while the structural provisions are taking effect.
Members of Congress wasted no time in criticizing the judge's ruling in the Microsoft case. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Members of Congress who have gone out of their way to court the high-tech industry quickly responded to Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson's order that Microsoft be split into two companies. Before the order was even released, House Majority Leader Dick Armey put out a statement in anticipation. Armey said he was shocked that one judge would presume to know exactly how the high-tech economy should evolve. Armey said Jackson's ruling was based on a snapshot of one moment in time, but that the picture was already outdated. He said the decision will divert innovative companies from creating better products, and added it is this ruling and not Microsoft that is damaging to consumers. Washington Republican Jennifer Dunn also anticipated the judge's ruling, saying today's the day our foreign competitors have waited for, the day the United States begins to choke its own economic engine. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
The R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company says it has no plans to change its advertising policy. Earlier this week, Reynolds' main competitor, Philip Morris, said it would stop advertising in magazines with younger readers. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports.
Philip Morris said Monday it would no longer promote cigarettes in magazines like Sports Illustrated or Rolling Stone, publications where more than 15% of the readers are children and teenagers. The company's decision resulted from discussions with state attorneys general about ways to reduce youth smoking. But R.J. Reynolds, the maker of such cigarettes as Winston and Salem, says it won't change its ad policies. A Reynolds spokesman says cigarette advertising doesn't cause young people to take up smoking, and the company says that restricting magazine ads would hurt its ability to sell cigarettes to adults. R.J. Reynolds will continue to advertise in publications where children and teens account for as much as a third of the readership, but the company says it examines such magazines closely to make sure both the articles and the other ads target adult readers. Adam Hochberg, NPR News.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 77 points to close at 10,813 in light trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 82 points, or 2.2%, to close at 3,839. This is NPR News. AT&T has changed its mind about a plan to raise long-distance telephone rates. The decision came after the Federal Communications Commission accused the giant telecommunications company of breaking its promise to pass savings along to consumers. Just last week, the FCC announced it would cut $3.2 billion from the access fees that AT&T and other companies, such as Sprint, have to pay to connect to local phone systems. President Clinton has ordered a change in the Medicare rules. Now, seniors who want to participate in experimental trials of drugs or other treatment will get financial help from Medicare. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from the White House.
This morning, the president said he was ordering the Department of Health and Human Services to approve bills that seniors submit for routine medical care during clinical trials. Clinical trials test experimental treatments for diseases that often affect seniors more than younger patients.
Today, America's seniors are badly underrepresented in clinical trials, yet they bear the heaviest share of illness. More than half of our cancer patients are over 65, but only a third of those in clinical trials are seniors.
A recent report from the National Academy of Sciences said that because seniors were uncertain about whether Medicare would pay their bills, they were not signing up for clinical trials that could prolong their lives and help find cures for a variety of fatal diseases. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
Russia's lower house of parliament has approved a flat income tax as part of an effort to reform the nation's tax system. The bill calls for a flat tax rate of 13%. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Arthur Sulzberger Jr., has been the publisher of the New York Times since 1992 and has also been chairman of the New York Times since 1997. He's a member of the fourth generation of his family to run the paper. His great-grandfather, Adolf Oakes, bought the Times in 1896. Sulzberger was named Publisher of the Year last month by Editor and Publisher magazine. The editorial explaining the choice said, Arthur Sulzberger Jr. certainly had the benefit of every advantage that comes with membership in one of the foremost newspaper families in the world. He easily could have managed to maximize profits and enrich both the family and the shareholders. Instead, he has revamped the organization, flattened the management structure, diversified the staff, moved boldly into digital media, and made the Times more accessible to a wider range of people other than white, upper-crust New Yorkers. The results are impressive. Circulation is up, profits at record levels. Sulzberger took over the paper just as the Internet was about to transform publishing. I think many journalists and editors agree that some stories are very important, but not necessarily popular. Some stories are very important to cover, but they won't necessarily attract a large readership. For example, certain international stories with countries that most people couldn't even find for you on the map. They're important stories. They're not going to be the most widely read ones. On the Internet, you can actually analyze exactly how many hits each page has had. So you can really tell how popular a story is, whether it's being read or not, how many people are reading it. I'm wondering how you're letting that guide, if at all, your decisions about how much time to spend, how much space to give to a news story now.
It's a very important question and one that we've grappled with not only since the time of the Internet, but for years. Because while the Internet gives you the ability to do that on a daily basis, the truth of the matter is that polling has given you a chance to do that on a regular basis for years. And in fact, when we were working in the late 80s and early 90s to rethink the Times, we did work research into what people were looking for, what were they interested in, how did they read the paper, and all of that information flowed up to the senior management team of the paper. And here's the simple way we look at it. We're going to give people stories on hunger in Somalia, whether they want it or not, because that is our responsibility to them and to democracy. And I've yet to see a research report that's ever has a reader saying, I really want more on the hunger in Somalia, or any of the stories akin to that. That's our job, and we're going to give that regardless of what people tell us. Now, when it comes to remaking the living section or weekend, there we have more flexibility. And if we discover that people really aren't interested in one area of coverage that we thought was important, but they're very much interested in another area that we didn't wasn't quite on our radar screen, well, we will adapt to that. Now, we're still obviously going to cover, just to take culture for a moment, we're still going to cover the theater and Broadway. We're still going to cover the music scene of jazz, which is not nearly as popular as other music, because that's part of who the New York Times is, of who we are. So you learn intuitively inside yourself where to listen and where it's inappropriate to listen. And that's why, you know, despite what everyone, what you're seeing around the around this country in what is, I think, a clear shift away from foreign coverage, we actually have more foreign bureaus and foreign reporters than we used to.
What are some of the most interesting things you've learned from surveys about readers and how they read your paper? Things that have led to what you consider to be good changes?
They don't make jumps the way we always thought they jumped from a page one story. I think that came as a little bit of a shock. You really got to have a compelling piece for them for many of our readers to jump to the inside pages.
So we're
writing briefer. Our stories are generally shorter. Now, do we still do major takeouts? Of course we do. But in a time when people really do say that they are pressed for time, you better be sure the story is very compelling.
So does this mean you're trying to condense more in the front page?
No, I don't think it means that. We're not trying to condense more in the front page. We're just we're being more judicious in our use of space.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Arthur Sulzberger, Jr., the publisher of the New York Times. Why did you want to go into the family business?
I wasn't talented enough to do anything else. If you don't accept that answer, I actually wasn't... I took it step by step. From the age of five, when I finally got over wanting to be a fireman, I went into, a high school newspaper side. I didn't wind up becoming the editor of the paper, but one of the senior editors. I stayed out of it in college. I wasn't even part of the college newspaper, and then jumped into it when I graduated and discovered, to my joy, that I really liked it. I loved reporting. I loved writing. And thought I'd make a career on the news side.
What was it like reading the paper when you were growing up and knowing that, you know, your family owned and published the paper? I mean, you must have felt a certain connection.
Well, first of all, I'm going to confess now that I wasn't one of those remarkable children who, at the age of seven, picks up the New York Times and settles down into an armchair. I think my first paper was perhaps the Daily News, and it wasn't until I got into high school that I started to really read the paper in depth. Because, quite frankly, until late in high school, junior, senior year, it wasn't that critical to my life. It only became more critical as you become, in my case, politically aware. Those are the days of the Vietnam War and the demonstrations, and the Times became, you know, an important tool to grow personally.
Did you feel like a traitor bringing the Daily News into your house?
No, of course not. I mean, any more than, in fact, I think my father subscribed to it. I think I read it there. If you read newspapers and if you love newspapers, you just don't read one. At least I don't. And we subscribe, for example, at home to the Wall Street Journal. And that's one of the joys of this business. It just doesn't have to be the New York Times.
What was the biggest newspaper or family crisis you remember from your childhood?
I think that would have to be the Pentagon Papers and my father having to fly back from London on the overnight plane to get back into this country because we just published the Pentagon Papers and the government was going crazy.
What's the closest you've come to having to decide what to publish? The closest to the Pentagon Papers. What's the closest? Yeah, sorry.
It has to be the. That's okay. It has to be. Well, that's a good question. Joe Lilyfeld was asked this question recently, and our executive editor, and he actually responded that that it was the presidential impeachment story and Monica Lewinsky and how we covered all of that. And I think from his perspective, from managing the newsroom on a day-to-day basis with a running story that was really pushing the envelope of what the New York Times was comfortable with, that's absolutely the right answer. But in my case, as publisher, the Unabomber it would be the moment where it was most critical as to whether or not we were going to publish something.
The Unabomber had sent, I think, you and the Washington Post letters basically saying that if you published his manifesto, he'd stop killing.
That's correct. And he gave us a lot of, thank goodness, a lot of time to make that decision as to whether or not we were going to publish. Either the Post or the Times or perhaps in unison certainly gave us time to come to some agreement internally at both papers and then to come to an agreement with each other and of course, with the Justice Department and the FBI, at least giving us some guidance and advice.
Yeah, you I don't know if it was you personally, but the Times took the letter to the FBI and the Justice Department and talked with them about the pros and cons of actually giving in to this demand and publishing the manifesto. What kind of discussion did you have before even bringing it to the Justice Department and the FBI? Discussion about whether it was appropriate to ask them about a news decision?
No, I didn't I don't think any of us felt it was inappropriate to ask. We often seek advice. It would have been inappropriate to be told what to do. And the Justice Department, to their credit, they never once told us what to do. They worked with us by giving us information. We also had people from the outside giving us information. But I think it's fair to say that when Don Graham and I walked in to meet with the Attorney General on that last meeting, we both knew that we were inclined, unless the Justice Department said, no, we don't think you should do this. We were inclined to publish it. The fact is, they then asked us to. So it was really a meeting of the minds.
Did you have any reservations about publishing it?
Oh, of course, I had reservations. How could you not have reservations? But I think the reservations were outweighed by the positive nature of what we thought we were doing. And in fact, as you know, it did indeed uncover who he was, and he was captured.
Is that because the brother read it in the Times or
he read it in the Washington? He read it in the Washington. The Washington Post wound up printing it, although that was a joint decision by the Times and the Post, and we covered half the costs. But we decided to only choose one paper in which to print it, and for reasons I'm not going to get into, we chose the Washington Post.
So the brother read it in there and recognized that this was probably his brother was probably the Unabomber.
That's right.
I think the big fear in doing something like this is that it's going to start a trend where other people say, well, I'll stop committing murder if you publish my manifesto.
Right. I consider this the New York Times plan for world peace. Every murderer and every terrorist group agreed that they would no longer murder or terrorize. I will open up these pages, and we'll just, in a couple of years, the world will be a truly better place. That sounds a little cynical, but in truth, this was not some guy who was saying he was going to kill somebody. This was somebody with a clear track record of murdering people and maiming people. And we had reasons to believe that he was also, and this will sound a little odd, a man of his word, and that in truth he was going to stop if we published it. So there were two or three different things at play here. But it was not an easy decision, and the brain trust we collected at the New York Times when we first sat down to discuss it was all over the map. Some people felt that we had no choice but to publish it. Others felt that it would be the absolute wrong decision to publish it. And by the end of the process, by the end of the month or two that we worked on this issue, we were unanimous in our decision.
Has anyone else written you and said, I will stop doing this if you publish my manifesto or my article? Have there been any copycats?
Not that's made it to me.
My guest is Arthur Sulzberger, Jr., publisher of the New York Times. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Arthur Sulzberger, Jr., publisher of the New York Times. Now, in your early years in newspapers, you worked Let's see, you worked at a paper in North Carolina. You worked for the Associated Press in London. You worked for the Times in many positions at the Metro desk as a foreign correspondent.
Not as a foreign correspondent. Washington correspondent for the New York Times, but never a foreign correspondent.
And I think you worked in the advertising department for a while.
Advertising, production,
Were you consciously trying to groom yourself to become publisher and learn everything you could about each aspect of the paper?
Probably. The big shift was really from the news side to the business side. And I must confess, I took that step with a lot of trepidation. I had a wonderful, I guess, almost a decade working as a reporter or editor for newspapers or wire services, and I loved that world. I didn't know whether or not I was made for the world of business. So when I moved to the advertising department to try my hand at that, I really thought that, if it doesn't work, I'll go back to news and make my career there. It turned out that I was, I found that the business side as compelling as the news side and rather enjoyed it. I won't say I was a great ad salesperson, but I learned a lot and kept proceeding. So I'm not sure it's quite as conscious as it sounds. It was a step-by-step process, and I took each job and just tried to enjoy it, and in truth, did.
How do you define your job now as publisher?
Strategy, I think, is the biggest my biggest concern. What is the strategic direction of the newspaper, and what's the strategic direction of the company? Because as I'm publisher of the Times, to be sure, but I'm also chairman of the New York Times Company, and that's a somewhat larger plate. Strategy, personnel, where's the next generation of leadership coming from? And moving, continuing to push the organization to become comfortable with things like the internet, with television, with new means of distributing the quality information, and always ensuring that the quality of what we produce is of the highest caliber.
What did you most not want to inherit about your father's life when you watched him running the New York Times?
Strikes.
Why was that the worst thing?
Because strikes suggest that in the end you couldn't find an accommodation between two important points of view. The need for leadership and management of a public company that has to have profits to succeed and grow, and the needs of the workforce, the men and women who are responsible in the end for producing that great newspaper. His was obviously a more difficult time than mine, but I think it's fair to say we've found a way to reach greater accommodation. It's not perfect. We still have issues, but it's not quite as volatile as it used to be.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Arthur Sulzberger Jr. is the publisher of the New York Times. Alan Siegel is often called the word czar of the New York Times. He's overseen usage and style since 1977. Siegel has co-authored a new edition of the Times Manual of Style and Usage, the first new version since 1976. In addition to explaining the difference between who and whom, that and which, and other confusing usage questions, and explaining when to use commas and semicolons, the book discourages writers from overusing puns, insists that reporters quote their sources accurately without cleaning up the quotes, offers advice on how to attribute sources who want to remain anonymous, and suggests graceful approaches to gender-free language. I asked Siegel how the style book is used at the paper.
We have 1,100 people on our news staff. That's a pretty shocking number. And most of what you read in the morning's New York Times is written between about 9 o'clock in the evening and midnight. And that's a lot of decision-making about language made very, very quickly. And this enables them all to be on the same page and not have to run around to a whole bunch of different reference books or ask somebody, do we spell it T-E-N or 1-0? And the style book has always been a good place to find out if something is slang, if it's too informal, for issues like who and whom, a quick place to check the answer rather than leaf through grammar books. And sometimes you just want to know, do we capitalize president or lowercase it, or capitalize cardinal or lowercase it? All of these things are in the style book.
What are some of the biggest changes in the Times style book between when you first got to the Times and now?
Well, the most famous thing that happened this time is that we caught up with some social policy issues that really differ today from what they were 23 years ago when we did this book last. We didn't allow people to say Ms. because we thought it was a political statement back then. We didn't allow the term gay because it was considered also too political or too politically correct for our readership in the 1960s and 70s. We changed that sometime in the 1980s, but the book still carried all of these outdated prohibitions. And then we also tried to do to reflect the end of the Cold War. A lot of country names changed and terminology changed. And 23 years ago, when we did this book last, there was no internet, there was no web. Nobody knew what WWW meant. It probably didn't mean anything.
In the foreword to the new New York Times Manual of Style and Usage, you quote a few paragraphs of writing that you think were, you know, particularly excellent. Let me read one of those paragraphs, and this is from a journalist, Barry Burak, and he was writing this from Afghanistan. It says, "With gunfire snapping in the wind and artillery blasts punctuating his sentences, the commander of the Taliban's frontline forces was in a boastful, triumphant mood today. He removed his artificial leg, sat comfortably on a blanket in his small brick fortress, and pointed a few hundred yards to the north, where, lodged in the foothills, was the last bastion of what was once grandly called the Northern Alliance. Quote, we are giving the enemy 10 days so that anybody who wants to get out can get out, said the commander, Haji Mullah Abdus Sattar. Then, by the will of God, we will crush the life from anyone who remains behind." Now, what principles of writing are illustrated in that paragraph?
First of all, Barry paints a word picture. You may forget the Afghan political situation sooner or later. You won't forget the picture of a guy unstrapping his artificial leg to give the interview. The gunfire is snapping in the wind. He uses brisk, active verbs. He doesn't beat around the bush. We will crush the life. Granted, that's the quote he's using. It's not Barry himself. But he selects vivid, direct language, short words, nothing fancy.
Alan Siegel co-wrote the New York Times new manual of style and usage. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, introducing the new performance lineup, the 9.5 Arrow and the 9.3 Viggen. Information available at saabusa.com and 1-800-SAAB-USA. From Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of 101 Ways by Mako Yoshikawa, and from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our talk with Alan Siegel, co-author of the New York Times New Manual of Style and Usage. And Lloyd Schwartz reviews the world premiere recording of Kurt Weill's 1932 opera, Die Burgschaft.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Alan Siegel, assistant managing editor of the New York Times. He has overseen style and usage there since 1977. He co-wrote the Times' new manual of style and usage. You have an interesting entry about slang in the Times' manual of style and usage. And I'm not sure you particularly, that you were the one who actually wrote this entry, but let me quote it anyways. It says, current slang can create the embarrassing spectacle of a grown-up who tries to pass for an adolescent. Some slang expressions will evolve into standard English. Others, like crunch for showdown and edgy, as in on the cutting edge, show up so relentlessly that they vault overnight from the novel to the hackneyed. I like that idea of current slang sounding like a grown-up trying to pass for an adolescent. What kind of slang do you find acceptable? What do you find objectionable? How do you draw that line?
When a writer has a good ear and he hears people using slang and he quotes it or even borrows it to create the scene that he or she witnessed, and it's fresh, the reader hasn't heard it lots of times that week or that month, that's good use of slang. When it's just prefabricated, when it makes the story sound like 20 or 30 other stories you've heard, and when it makes us sound like some other publication, then it's a false note. I happened to look up the expression poster boy the other day, and I found that in the last 30 days, the Times has called people poster boys for one thing or another 20 times. Now, clearly, that expression is in trouble.
Right. So is this the kind of thing that you do sometimes, is checking the computer how many times a certain expression has been used to see if it's crossed the line into cliché yet?
The computer helps us to verify our instincts. I discovered that we've suddenly started referring to people by this basketball figure, go-to guy, meaning the person you can trust in a pinch. And suddenly in the last week, everybody's been a go-to guy for one thing or another. The Prime Minister of Britain has an aide who is a go-to guy. Well, it's going to get stale very fast.
Let me get to an expression that's used a lot that you discourage in the style book, and that's inner city. What don't you like about inner city?
It's come to be a euphemism. It usually means black or black and poor, and it's imprecise. The inner city of Manhattan is the Upper East Side and the Upper West Side, and they're not any of the things that we usually talk about when we say inner city. But there's something worse about it. If you use a euphemism when what you really want to say is black and Latino and poor, it sounds as if you think there's something wrong with those expressions. Well, there's nothing wrong with being black or Latino or poor. And there's nothing wrong with talking about those traits in straightforward, direct language.
If what someone was trying to say was that the neighborhood was poor and it was predominantly African-American in population, how would you have them rewrite it without using inner city?
I'd have them say exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
Or very often when I see inner city in copy, I say, what do you mean? Let's just say what we mean.
Mm-hmm.
If inner city kids have been more exposed to this illness or this problem in school, let's say what kind of kids we mean.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, what about using African-American versus black or Native American versus Indian? How do you suggest your writers decide which is the more appropriate way to describe a group?
Well, we learned from our experience. A little while ago, you and I were talking about the years when the Times wouldn't use Ms. or gay, and that caused a fair amount of bitterness both outside the paper, ultimately, and inside the paper. And that recollection has made it very easy for us to deal with questions like Latino versus Hispanic or African American versus black. We simply encourage our writers to ask people how they'd like to be referred to, organizations, people we write about. There's nothing really wrong with using any of those expressions if they're comfortable in context.
Of course, like if you're talking about a large group of African-Americans, some of the people in that group will prefer the word black and some of the people will prefer African-American, so then you're kind of lost.
If we get lost, we count on our writers to use their judgment and find the way. What we have told our folks is let the writer make the choice. The writer's name is going to be on the story. The writer should be accountable for that kind of choice.
Now, one thing the New York Times hasn't budged on is you still can't just call somebody by their last name. It has to be Mr. Miller, not Miller, or, you know, Ms. Gross, not just Gross. And one way, you're probably familiar with this example, if you're talking about a King Kong, Mr. Kong, a seven-story simian.
There are lots of, I'm happy to say that all of those myths are just that, myths.
Right.
There's one about the pop singer Meatloaf, who is alleged to have been called Mr. Loaf.
Right.
It didn't happen. We do use last names standing by themselves in our sports pages, of course, as everyone does, and in our magazine and in our Sunday Book Review, because those are more leisurely, different-sounding publications than the main part of the newspaper. But in the newspaper, we think there is a value to stopping and calling people Mr. or Ms. or Mrs. or Miss, if that's what they prefer, in exactly the same way that Congress people refer to each other as the distinguished representative from Georgia. Now, the speaker may or may not think that the representative from Georgia is particularly distinguished, but it's a courtesy that keeps the conversation at a level of civility, and we believe that in that very much in discussion of public issues.
Jim, trying to remember how you deal with hip-hop performers like Chuck D. Does he become Mr. D.?
We probably repeat the whole name all the time. No, we wouldn't call him Mr. D.
Right.
I guess the first rule of style is don't be ridiculous.
Uh-huh. Now, there's a lot of linguistic wars over things like pro-abortion or pro-choice, pro-life or anti-abortion. What advice do you have on that?
We try very hard to choose language that won't let any personal sentiment be visible or present in what we write. We don't say pro-choice because that's the term used by one of the sides in the debate. At the same time, we don't say pro-abortion because that's what the other side uses, or pro-life. We try to talk about abortion rights advocates, the abortion rights position, the anti-abortion position. We try to use language that neither side would contest. Now, I have to admit to you that we have come up against one piece of that debate that we don't know how to solve. The surgical procedure that is called by its critics partial birth abortion, there is simply no neutral way to say that. And if anybody has suggestions, please write to me at the New York Times.
What are some of the things you've come up with and then rejected?
Oh, there are all kinds of the technical expression for it is intact dilation and curettage, which is incomprehensible to most readers, and I'm told it isn't particularly precise anyway. And I don't remember what all the others are that we have tried to use, but we generally now use the expression partial birth abortion, but we say that it is what one side calls it. It's a very unsatisfactory solution.
My guest is Alan Siegel. He oversees style and usage at the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alan Siegel. He co-wrote the New York Times' new manual of style and usage. Can you give us a sense of what the line of editing is like? A reporter writes a story. How many editors read it before it's published? What are their different functions in the process of editing?
Well, at this point, if I don't tell you that much of the time there's too much editing, my boss will kill me, because Joe Lelyveld, the executive editor, has made a kind of crusade of convincing the staff that the best editing is the editing that involves one writer and one editor, one-stop shopping, everything that needs to get done gets done in one pass. And if the story is long enough and complicated enough and we need to go back at it again, then the same editor deals with the writer who has dealt with her or him first time round. Now, that doesn't always happen. But typically, a story written for the daily paper is assigned by one editor, or at least discussed by that editor with the reporter who's going to write it, When it's turned in, it's looked at by a second editor who is an assistant editor in the department, Metropolitan News or National News or Arts News. And then it goes to a copy editor when the assistant editor is satisfied that it's organized correctly, that it's about the right length, that there are no glaring omissions of facts. It goes to a copy editor whose role ought to be just to check spelling, grammar, and compliance with the style book, and then to write the headline. Now, of course, a good copy editor will catch omissions that others have made and ideally will go back and say to the supervising editor, hey, you forgot to tell us whether this legislation is likely to be voted by the other house. Does the president plan to sign it or not? That kind of thing can slip by the first line editor. But ideally, there's one substantive editor on every story and then a mechanical copy editing phase.
I want to talk to you about obscenity, vulgarity, and profanity. The style book says the Times writes unblushingly about sexual behavior, art censorship, science, health, crime, and similar subjects, opening its columns to any newsworthy detail, however disturbing, provided the approach is dignified and the vocabulary clinical rather than coarse. Tell us what your guidelines are for obscenity, vulgarity, profanity. If you're describing a rape, or you're describing a painting that is the subject of censorship and the painting or the photograph is explicit in its sexuality.
We learned a lesson during the Mapplethorpe controversy about the sexually explicit homosexual photographs, in which we were describing them in ways that were so general and vague that readers told us they had no idea why there was a censorship issue. And we took away from that a sense that we really ought to talk in grown-up language about exactly which body parts were seen doing what. And I think we do that equally in a newsworthy rape story. Happily, we don't, as a newspaper, cover the amount of crime that would cause that to be on every page of the Metropolitan section every day. But when we cover a highly newsworthy sex crime, we're very explicit about the body parts and the specific activities that were mentioned at the trial.
How did the Times describe Mapplethorpe's work at the time of the controversy, and how would that have changed now?
I think toward the end of that, the development of that story, we talked very specifically about, I don't think you want to go into it on the radio, I think, but there were you know, objects placed in body openings that we had referred to in generalizations in some of our earlier stories, and we were very specific about it later on, because if it became a constitutional issue, and if readers are going to have an opinion about what the Constitution should allow and what it should prohibit, we think we owe them the basic textbook guidance about what the argument's about.
Now, you sometimes, the Times often runs corrections when there's been a misspelling or a person has been called by the wrong name or a photograph has been inaccurately identified. You also run editor's notes to rectify lapses of fairness, balance, or perspective. How do you decide when a piece is worthy of that kind of editor's note?
Very often, reporters or editors come over to me and say, this is what happened in today's paper. Is it worth a correction? And my answer to them is always, if you were writing that story now, knowing what you know now, would you do it that way? They always say, no, of course not. Then I say, well, there's still time to fix it. At least fix the record, fix your conscience. And we put a correction in the paper or an editor's note.
A good example of that?
Yes, there was an editor's note just the other day where we had written about an interview with Betty Friedan, the feminist author, and she, in her new book, accuses her former husband of having physically abused her, and we described that at some length. I gather we did try to reach her husband for comment, and for some very peculiar reason, his telephone number, even though it was listed, wasn't available from directory assistance. This sounds like I can see you raising your eyebrows, but in fact, that's really what happened. And we never got his side of the story into the paper. And then he wrote us a letter asking that his side of the story get in the paper, and we edited the letter for length because it wasn't necessary to go on at the length that he did, or at least we didn't have space available to let him do that. And we put his view in the paper in the form of a letter, and as luck will have it, and sometimes these things just are luck, the next letter in the letters column, right under his, was another letter from another reader who believed the accusation against him, and so it had the effect of completely wiping out the equal time we had tried to give him. Well, he wrote to us and complained about that, and we ran an editor's note saying that, first of all, we should have tried harder and found a way to get his response into the same story as the accusation, and that, secondly, when we then ran a letter from him, we shouldn't have coupled it with another letter from a reader who didn't believe him. That made us look, at least to careful readers, as if we had a conscience in handling that story, rather than saying, you know, we own the printing press and to heck with you, Mac.
My guest is Alan Siegel, and he is he has overseen usage and style at the New York Times since 1977, and he's the co-author of the new New York Times Manual of Style and Usage. Color photos. When the New York Times added color photos on its front page, I think a lot of people felt, well, that's just it, because newspapers are supposed to have black and white photos, and color is what USA Today does. Color is what magazines and USA Today do. How do you think color photos have affected the paper one way or another, and has it given you a longer deadline? In other words, do you have to go to press sooner in order to print the color photos?
Well, I'll take the last part first. No, we don't, because desktop publishing technology came along so quickly that we can print color photos now just about as quickly as we can print black and white. Occasionally, we may have to close the color portion of a page 15 or 20 minutes before we close the black and white, but we can keep the black and white open till the last minute. People used to say to me, as I was on one of the planning groups that worked out the conversion to color in the paper, people used to say, I don't want you to do that. You know, it's going to make the Times into a comic book. And I used to say, life happens in color. We give it to you in black and white. Can you name any place else in the newspaper where we knowingly give you less than we know, less than the whole truth? If we know that the president is married to a redhead, or the president is himself a redhead, and we just show you his hair in gray, can you think of any place else in the paper where we are systematically withholding information? It was a way of telling people more, of giving them more of what the scene looked like. Now, we knew that we were going to do it in a way that was conservative in design terms and responsible and consistent with the look of the paper as it had been all along. At this point, I should put in a plug for my colleague, Tom Bodkin, who is the design director and who really devoted years of his life to making sure that when we went to color, it would be with the same values and the same emphasis as the black and white that we did. But readers have been gratifyingly understanding about that, I think, because we occasionally get complaints about various things, but I know of almost no complaints about color as such.
How many newspapers a day do you read?
Four or five, the local New York ones, and I certainly try to do justice by the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal.
And why is it important to read those?
To know who's doing as well as we are, who maybe did something better, who has an idea that's worth expanding on in our own paper, and for that matter, who's following us, what kinds of things we've done that have had enough impact so that others felt that it was necessary to go back and do them the next day.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Terry. Thank you very much.
Alan Siegel co-wrote the New York Times New Manual of Style and Usage. Coming up, one of Kurt Weill's most neglected works is now on CD. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of Kurt Weill and the 50th anniversary of his death. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that one of the most significant events of these landmark dates is the revival and first recording of one of Weill's most neglected works, the opera Die Bürgschaft, The Pledge.
Kurt Weill's political and moral fable, Die Bürgschaft, The Bond, or The Pledge, was first performed in Berlin in 1932, just before the Nazi takeover, which is one of the reasons it wasn't performed in Germany again until more than a decade after World War II. It was also Weill's major break with his collaborator Bertolt Brecht, with whom he'd worked on 8 previous pieces, including Three Penny Opera and The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, a partnership that produced, among countless memorable numbers, Mac the Knife, Surabaya Johnny, the Alabama Song, and the Bilbao Song. His new librettist was Kaspar Neher, Brecht and Weill's brilliant set designer. Neher's story owes a lot to Brecht's plays, though the tone is less satirical than appalled and saddened at the way money and power undermine the pledge, the social bond, the human instinct for kindness, public or personal. Ultimately, Neher's plot goes back to a parable in the Talmud in which kindness and generosity prevail over self-interest. But it's not people who change, the chorus keeps reminding us. It's the circumstances that change people. The particular circumstance of this opera is the invasion of an ominous great power. In the end, the kind man who once pledged to cover his friend's debt coldly refuses to protect him from a murderous mob. This grim fable foreshadows not only the Nazis, but also the corporate greed of the 1990s. Yet if the tone is different from Brecht's glittering cynicism, the music remains unmistakably Weill's, though from the very first notes, he achieves a new level of urgency and momentum. Weill's orchestration, especially his use of winds, reaches new expressive heights. The composer Ernst Bloch said this music had a touch of a Jewish Verdi to it. Weill uses small and large choruses in an extraordinary variety of ways. Each individual number fits into a larger design with cinematic fluidity. Die Bürgschaft combines the simple narrative of folk opera with the solemn choral pronouncements of oratorio. The performance, conducted by Julius Rudel, is by turns hard-driving and lyrical, and shot through with nervous energy. It's too bad Weill didn't live to see a revival of this ambitious work. It may never be as popular as the Threepenny Opera, but anyone who loves Weill's music will cherish it.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Kurt Weill's opera, Die Bürgschaft, was recorded at last year's Spoleto Festival. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Schurach directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Little Brown & Company, publisher of Me Talk Pretty One Day by David Sedaris, available in bookstores nationwide. From Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the Internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide at www.alcatel.com. And from Random House, Inc., Crown Division, publishers of The Forest, the novel by Edward Rutherford, author of London and Sarum. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm gone, I'm walking, walking down to the park.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of the Chess Brothers and their label Chess Records. And we meet one of the first women bodybuilders, Pudgy Stockton, who was known as the Queen of Muscle Beach in the 1940s, and her husband, former bodybuilder Les Stockton. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
I'm gone hard walking down on the avenue.